Chapter 32.
David Blackwood, said Oliver, was a loving husband, a devoted father, and an absolute demon on the golf course. We all remember him as...
He looked down at his cards.
David Blackwood, said Oliver, was a loving husband, a devoted father, and...
He looked down again. Then he looked up, and his eyes moved over the crowd, pausing just for a second on me, before he fixed his attention back on a neutral point.
David Blackwood, he said, was a complicated man. And the last words I said to him were, go fuck yourself.
The nice thing about Oliver's family being incredibly British and middle class was that nobody had any way to react to that, so everyone stayed very still and very silent.
I wish they had not been,
Oliver went on.
And I suppose that might seem obvious. After all, who wants their last words to their father to be, go fuck yourself? But I think what's not so obvious is that while I'm sorry he's dead, I hope no one here would think that I'm not sorry he's dead. I'm a vegan criminal defence lawyer, for fuck's sake, neither of which my father approved of, incidentally. But in general, I don't believe death ever solves anything. Another thing my father disapproved of. He was a proponent of bringing back hanging, which he apparently thought would fix knife crime, the economy, and, if I recall from at least one conversation, immigration. But my point is that although I'm sorry he's dead, and this might be the part that surprises people, and Mother in particular, I'm sorry if this surprises you. I'm inordinately glad I told him to go fuck himself. As I say, David Blackwood was a complicated man. And indeed, one of the questions I find myself asking now is whether he too, had he survived, would have been glad I told him to go fuck himself. I believe that if he lived by the principles he espoused, he would. After all, as well as hanging, he was also a great proponent of speaking your mind. When he did it, that is, not so much when other people did. And standing your ground. Again, primarily his ground, not necessarily anybody else's. But I hope that the double standard he applied to those virtues when it came to his employees, my schoolteachers, tradesmen, waiters, most of his friends, and his son's various romantic partners might at least not apply to his own children. I like to imagine that maybe, one day, after perhaps a year or two had passed, he'd have shaken my hand and said, "You know what, Oliver? I had that coming." Because I'm afraid, from my perspective, he did, indeed, have it coming. And again, I don't want anyone to think that I hated my father, or that I wanted anything bad to happen to him. When I say he was a complicated man, I mean it. He wasn't good or bad. He wasn't always right or always wrong, although he would personally have disagreed with you on that score. And I should also say that all I can really talk about now is the David Blackwood I knew, who won't be the David Blackwood my mother knew or Uncle Jim knew. He's probably fairly similar to the David Blackwood that Christopher knew, but he won't be exactly the same. That's the thing about people. I suppose in a way we're all complicated men, or women, or non-binary people. And thinking about it, if there's one thing I've done today that would really, truly offend David Blackwood, it's bothering to acknowledge that non-binary people exist at his funeral. "Why do you have to be so bloody politically correct, Oliver?" he might have said. "What about women's bathrooms?" Where was I? My original draft of this speech opened with, as you might recall, David Blackwood was a loving husband, a devoted father, and a demon on the golf course. And all of those things were true. Well, except the thing about golf. He was actually quite bad at it. And so when I say he had it coming, with reference to, in case you've forgotten, my telling him to go fuck himself, I don't think I really mean that. At least not as it came out. I think what I mean was he needed to hear it, and I needed to say it. Because my father provided for me, and cared for me, and supported me, but he also undermined me, made constant jokes about my sexuality, while also being incredibly offended by any suggestion he might be even a little bit homophobic, and wielded his disapproval like... I'm sorry. Normally when I'm speaking for work, I'm rather better prepared, so I don't have a good simile to hand. But I spent my entire life repulsed by his beliefs, terrified of his scorn, and desperate for him to think well of me. Although, strangely, or perhaps not, I can't tell, I never once doubted that he loved us. I think that's what made it so very difficult. Because everything he did, everything he said, every belittling remark about my career, every snide joke about anal sex, and I'm terribly sorry, I've now just said anal sex at my father's funeral. I suppose there's no coming back from that, really, is there? All of it came from a place that felt to him like affection. And because he was proud and stubborn, and those are qualities I recognise in myself and value in myself, and in some ways have to thank him for, it would never have occurred to him, could never have occurred to him, that if he'd just listen, for once just listen to a voice that wasn't his own, he'd see that... And that's where I run out of words. Because I'm not sure what it was I wanted him to see, not really. I suppose I wanted him to see that he was a complicated man, and that I, too, was a complicated man, that Christopher and I were both complicated men, that being me wasn't just a failure state of being him. Of course, maybe he knew all that already. Maybe I just didn't know that he knew it, and he didn't know that I didn't know, so we just missed each other for 30 years. Or maybe he just didn't give a fuck. Maybe he went to his grave genuinely disappointed that his eldest son was a fairy. The thing is, I have no way of telling. And I suppose that's why I say he had it coming. I suppose what I really mean is we had it coming. That we would at some point in our lives have to reconcile ourselves either to gradually and politely becoming strangers or to me telling him to go fuck himself. Because I'd hoped that, and I'll never know if I was right, and perhaps I'm just projecting this retrospectively onto something I said in the heat of the moment, that there was no looking away from a go fuck yourself. David Blackwood was a complicated man, and he was the kind of man who only ever heard what he wanted to hear. But a loud, clear go fuck yourself, I thought that would get through to him. Or, if it didn't, then at least I would know. Anyone who knew David... That's the kind of thing you say at a funeral, isn't it? Anyone who knew David. Anyone who knew him would know that he was a man of statements. In his world, things were as they were, and there was no interrogating that, or changing it, or denying it. I suppose that explains why he was so threatened by the idea of non-binary people, even though he never met one. He believed what he believed, and, like Thomas Jefferson, he considered those beliefs to be self-evident truths. He was a complicated man, but he was, at heart, a man of certainties. Which is why it's so strange to me. Strange and more than a little painful that here, at the end, he has left, for me at least, only questions. Had he not, in his typically contrarian fashion, collapsed of a heart attack a few short weeks after I'd finally taken his advice, advice, Uncle Jim, you will be pleased that I remembered well from the Halibut story, and stood up for myself, I might have known if we could perhaps... if he would have... But I won't. I'll never know. And that's what death is, really, isn't it? A lot of things you'll never know. Although the truth is, I can't help but feel that if I'd just told my father to go fuck himself 10 years ago, we might have been in a much better place today. and I might have been able to stand here and join all of you in pretending my father was simple, even though he wasn't, because none of us are. Also, I can't help but notice that I've ended this long and, I freely admit, unfortunately rambling speech about my difficult relationship with David Blackwood by questioning, yet again, whether the problem was me all along. I'm like my father, I think, in several ways, but that isn't one of them. He would never once ask that question. It would be straightforward to him. Oliver, you need to pull your socks up and stop making excuses. I suppose that's another irony, that a man so obsessed with personal responsibility was so insistent on everything being somebody else's fault, even the halibut. But then I suppose he saw no contradiction in that. Don't do as I do as I say, and so on. And in a way, didn't it work? Because perhaps the end of all this is that I like who I am. I like that I am, at last, the sort of person who can tell his father to go fuck himself, and also the kind of person who can accept that perhaps I should have said it earlier, or not said it at all. My father was a man of certainties, but I think I am happy being a man of questions. So often I think, when a person dies, when a complicated person dies, even when an unambiguously awful person dies, not that I believe there are any truly unambiguously awful people, it's for those of us left behind to pick over ourselves and ask, am I this way in spite of this person, or because of them? And so often the answer is simply, yes. I am sorry that my father is dead. I am sorry that we will never get to finish the conversation that began when I told him to go fuck himself. I will miss him, as I know we all will. But for all that I will miss him, for all that I loved him, and for all that I believed, without question, that he loved me, I still find myself standing in front of you now, and this is the only thing I feel able to say with confidence, the only thing I know to be true and fair about someone who is no longer able to speak for himself. David Blackwood was a complicated man. Now, assuming there is still time, I rather mean-spiritedly assigned Christopher to read If. It was Dad's favourite poem, because of fucking course it was. Stepping away from the lectern, Oliver walked slightly unsteadily back to his seat. Then he put his head in his hands and very quietly started to cry. I wrapped my arms around him and drew him close while Christopher took his place. "If you can keep your head," he began with palpable resentment, "when all about you are losing theirs." Chapter 33. "Mother is never going to forgive me," said Oliver. We were sitting on the wall outside the crematorium while the rest of the mourners trickled past on the way to the wake, which was being held at the Blackwoods' house, and I wanted to say something supportive, but he was probably right. "I mean, people surprise you?" "I think I just surprised her in the worst possible way." Blinking, he wiped his eyes, which were still a little red. "I don't know what I was thinking." "Well, I suppose it was sort of a combination of grief, frustration and confusion, which is pretty par for the course for funerals." "Yes, but I didn't have to tell everybody." He dropped his head into his hands. "I mean, who does that? Who goes to his own father's funeral and gives a rather incoherent speech about how he wasn't a very nice person, actually?" "Would you have preferred," I asked, in a vain attempt to lighten the mood, "to have made a coherent speech about how he wasn't a very nice person?" He glanced up. "Obviously. I'm a lawyer." "Barrister," I corrected, and that at least won a tiny smile. It didn't last, though. Oliver lowered his head back into his hands. "I feel like such a fool." "You shouldn't," I told him. "It was really brave of you." I mean, there was me, thinking the options were eulogy or no eulogy. But, dark horse that you are, you went through the door marked Extemporaneous Monologue About Fatherhood and Loss. Oliver made a mortified groaning noise into his hands.
You're not going to be able to make me laugh about this, Lucien. I've done a terrible thing.
Okay, one, I put up a finger. You know when you say I won't be able to make you laugh, I take that as a challenge, even at a funeral. Two, you haven't done a terrible thing. You've just done a thing. And yes, it was a slightly unconventional thing, and I don't think it's going to become a Blackwood family tradition, but you needed to say it, and at least some people in that room needed to hear it. He lifted his head again.
I have a therapist for exactly this reason.
And, I said, you can talk to her about it on Tuesday.
I don't know how I'm going to live with myself. I mean, he went on quickly, not in a suicidal ideation kind of way. In an I'm not sure how I can continue to have self-respect kind of way.
I put an arm across his shoulders. Hey, I did without self-respect for ages. It's very overrated. He gave in and laughed at that. And because it was his father's funeral and he'd just gone through something intense and traumatic, I didn't shout, Boom! Challenge defeated! Instead, I went on. Look, maybe think of it like this. Yes, you could have gone up there and delivered the eulogy your mum wanted, but would that have meant anything? Except that the last thing you said about your father was a lie.
Is that better or worse than the last thing I said about my father being a string of criticism?
You said yourself, he had it coming.
Yes, but that was a rhetorical device.
I gave him a squeeze. Well, I suppose we did come to bury David Blackwood, not to praise him.
Lucien?
He looked unflatteringly surprised.
Was that a Shakespeare reference?
Hey, I did English A-level, admittedly because I thought it would be a dossy subject, but I have read Julius Caesar. Or rather, I've read that specific speech because I expected it to come up on the exam. Laughing, he turned my face towards his and kissed me gently with closed lips.
I do love you. I love you very much.
I love you too, I told him, and I'm very proud of you. I think you did something that you had to do. And fuck whatever anyone else thinks. I paused. But just to be clear, when I die, I want the full he was the best person ever and definitely had no faults treatment.
You're that convinced you'll predecease me?
You do all the bullshit stuff you're supposed to do to take care of yourself, like flossing and taking exercise and eating vegetables without being forced.
True.
He lifted his brows at me.
On the other hand, I now have a family history of sudden heart failure.
I winced. That was one of those jokes that only close relatives were allowed to make, especially at the actual funeral. Looking around the courtyard, I noticed that most of the mourners had gone, which meant we should probably be goning too. Do you feel, I started, are you okay to go to the wake? Before Oliver could reply, I noticed that one of the few people who hadn't gone was Christopher, who had just come out of the crematorium and was now bearing down on us with Mia trailing behind him like somebody who really did not want to be trailing. What the fuck, Oliver? He asked the moment he was within earshot. Oliver looked up. In his defence, he did seem at least a little contrite.
I'm sorry, Christopher. It wasn't planned.
Somehow, Christopher didn't seem mollified.
I don't care if it was planned, it was fucking selfish. You get up and do this big, ooh, isn't it weird how there's this social convention that we don't shit-talk people at funeral speech, like you're an observational comic from 2006?
He wasn't exactly shouting. The Blackwoods hadn't been a shouty family. Or rather, they'd been a family in which shouting was a monopoly tightly controlled by a man who was now dead.
And then I have to come up and read fucking Kipling like a complete knobhead, so we can all get on with pretending that the stupid selfish thing you just did never happened.
It was pretty much the exact opposite of what Oliver's self-esteem needed right then. He hung his head.
And I'm sorry. I really am.
It was one speech, Ollie. One tiny little speech to give us all a quiet life. And now I've got to go and stop Mum having a total fucking breakdown.
And somewhere, the part of Oliver that had finally been ready to confront his father got off the bench. Literally, in a way. Because he stood up, straightened his suit, and said,
I understand that you're upset.
Don't give me that.
No, Christopher.
Oliver was icy calm now, in a way I had learned to be either afraid of or turned on by, depending on context. This was 50-50.
I'm afraid I'm giving you exactly that. Because it wasn't one speech, was it? It was a speech and organising the entire funeral, and staying with Mother for a full week after Father died, much of which, I may add, I spent trying and failing to contact you to tell you our father had died, because she couldn't. And it was Christmas, and the Christmas before, and the one before that. It was Mum's 60th birthday, and Dad's 60th, and Great Uncle Benji's funeral, and everything else that you just couldn't quite make because the first chance you got, you ran away to the other side of the world.
Christopher folded his arms. But, although I admit I was biased, it was the kind of defiance you got from somebody who knows the other person has a point.
Oh, yes. Your brilliant theory that I spent 5 years at medical school, went through junior doctor training, and now work for one of the most prestigious international aid organisations in the world, just to stick you with our parents.
I'm not doubting your commitment to what you do.
Oliver's calm was holding up, but barely.
But can you please just once admit that the consequence of your rather international lifestyle is that I've borne the brunt of...
I'll admit no such fucking thing, snapped Christopher.
It didn't seem like either of them were in much of a mood to let the other finish a sentence.
You moved out 2 years before I did. You were financially independent before I was. You didn't have them micromanaging your wedding and your marriage and making your wife feel like shit for...
I'm sorry.
Oliver gave his brother the politest of smiles.
Were you about to lecture your gay brother on how hard it has been for you to put up with our parents' opinions about your romantic relationships?
For a moment, Christopher didn't have a reply, probably because there was no good way to answer.
That was low?
Oh, was it? Did the impact of our parents' constant low-key homophobia on me somehow inconvenience you?
Fuck off, Ollie. Just fuck off.
At last, Mia caught up with us. She hadn't actually been that far away, but given the raised voices and intense body language, she hadn't been in a major hurry to join the party.
Cleared the air yet?
She asked.
Christopher has just told me to fuck off, said Oliver. So no.
Mia sighed.
Christopher, you promised.
He played the gay card,
Christopher protested. I winced.
Can we maybe not say gay card? It's kind of a right-wing talking point that needs to die in a fire.
Somehow, it always seemed easier for the Blackwood brothers to be conciliatory with each other's partners than each other. And Christopher continued the tradition.
Sorry, Luke. I meant, let's stop playing the who had it worst game and accept that there's an outside chance growing up was shit for both of us.
Didn't I just do that?
Said Oliver, archly. Christopher scowled.
You just made a whole speech about how crap your childhood was.
And yours as well,
Oliver pointed out, with a level of pedantry I didn't think was totally well judged in the circumstances.
I didn't think it was fair to speak on your behalf.
You could have consulted me.
Again, it wasn't planned.
Or...
For a moment, the look in Christopher's eyes was a lot like the one Oliver got when I was being particularly difficult with him.
You could have talked to me at any time in the last 30 years.
I would have, but you were in...
Oliver began. Then he stopped. Then he tried again.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to be reasonable, but...
He took a deep, I am going to articulate a complex thought breath.
It wasn't easy for me when we were younger. Nothing I did was ever good enough for our parents. Whereas you...
Whereas I what? Demanded Christopher.
Come on. You were always the golden boy.
At that, Christopher gave a hollow, single-shot laugh, like a bark. Oh, was I?
Do you know how long they kept reminding me that you got better A-level grades than I did?
Well, I did. Christopher gave a near-defiant, near-smirk.
That's because the A-star grade didn't exist when I did mine. I got the best grades I could at the time.
The near-smirk vanished, but the defiance got more defiant. And I didn't. They had a go at me for only getting an A in maths until I was 3 years into my medical degree. Mia took half a step forward. She looked like she was about to pull out one of the last pins in a game of kaplunk.
Is it possible, she asked, just possible, that they might have made you both think they liked the other one more?
Nonsense, said Christopher and Oliver at once. Every time I spoke to them, Oliver went on, slightly faster than his brother, it was, Christopher is going to be a doctor. Christopher has the loveliest girlfriend. Christopher said the most interesting thing to us the last time we spoke to him.
Oliver wouldn't be out so late on a school night, Christopher shot back. Oliver knows how to do what he's told. Oliver makes time for us.
Well, I did, Oliver snapped back. Instead of spending all my time backpacking and sightseeing and running around with my friends. Friends, by the way, who they made very certain to tell me all about.
He lapsed back into his parents' voice.
We don't see nearly as much of Christopher as we'd like, but then you have to give young boys their freedom, and he's so very popular.
Mia gave me a look of desperation, and I did my best to intervene. Guys, I tried, one of you is a barrister, the other one's a doctor. You are both way too smart to still be falling for this shit.
What shit?
Asked Christopher, and to my dismay, he seemed to genuinely mean it. Ollie here did everything they wanted, so when I didn't, I got hell. Oliver sneered. He actually sneered. It was like I was dating the evil one in a costume drama, the one who's determined to steal the hero's tin mine.
You mean you did whatever the hell you liked, and they still thought the sun shone out of your backside, so I had to work twice as hard to get half as much?
I can't believe you would even suggest... Mia, I announced, over the top of the Blackwood brothers. Do you want to just run off together? I know I'm gay, but I reckon I can work something out. Stepping pointedly in between Christopher and Oliver, Mia took my hand.
Yeah, let's go to Paris.
Christopher flung a glance at us.
What are you two doing?
We're leaving you for each other,
Mia explained.
Because you're both awful.
I mean, I added, you're both in your late 20s or early 30s, and you've been talking about your fucking A-level results. There was a little silence. Not a, this man has made a good point and we're chill now kind of silence. More an okay corral kind of silence. At last, Oliver took one of his trademark, I am being calm and mature and you are not breaths.
Perhaps we are being a little heated. Christopher, I understand that what I did today caught you unawares, and in an ideal world, I should have said something to you beforehand.
He'd been trying to be conciliatory, but Christopher didn't look conciliated. I should have said something to you beforehand. Is that the best you can do?
I shouldn't have asked you to read if.
Normally I loved Oliver's dry half-jokes, but this clearly wasn't the time. How about if you were going to find the backbone to talk back to our... To our complete... prick of a father. The moment the words were out, something lifted from Christopher Blackwood. A small something, admittedly, but something. You should have done it when he was alive. When it could be at least a tiny bit of use to either of us. A similar something, and similarly small, seemed to shift in Oliver too.
I didn't plan for this.
I know you didn't. Just... fuck. Christopher pulled at his hair in frustration. I really, really, really resent having to go here, because I in no way want to validate your grandstanding bullshit. But you remember that thing you said about how the worst of it is you'll never know how it would have been different if you'd called him on his bullshit earlier?
Unfortunately not, Oliver admitted. I'm afraid looking back it's rather a blur, but it feels like something I remember wanting to say.
Well, how do you think I felt listening to that?
And there was the note of challenge in Christopher's voice again, but under that, a note of pleading.
Don't you think I wanted to know what my life might have been like if you'd stood up for me just fucking once before you were fucking 30?
Oliver went very still, in that way he had when he was very angry or very devastated.
I wasn't aware you needed to be stood up for.
I know you weren't.
Christopher's shoulders slumped, and with a stiffness that made him briefly look much older, he sat down where Oliver had just been sitting.
I, said Oliver finally, I fear I may have been a bad brother. I apologize.
Lifting his arm, Christopher dragged his wrist across his eyes, like he wasn't sure whether he was about to cry or not.
I'll be honest, I really thought it would feel better to hear that.
If it helps, Oliver offered. I thought it would feel better to tell Dad to go fuck himself.
Well,
Christopher gave a slightly helpless shrug.
Thanks for saying it anyway. And I guess I was kind of a crappy brother too.
Mia cleared her throat.
Or you had fucked up parents, and this isn't on either of you.
The seesaw of recrimination and self-recrimination hovered briefly in the middle, and for a moment it looked like the Blackwood brothers might get off the ride, maybe even leave the playground entirely. But then, there was only so much you could fix with one conversation. Eventually, Oliver said,
I'm sorry I ruined the funeral.
Christopher seemed to be deep in a think space, so Mia gave a laconic shrug.
I wouldn't say you ruined it. It was more interesting than most eulogies. Besides, half the crowd probably weren't paying attention, and the other half secretly knew you had a point.
I think that's overly generous,
replied Oliver, with reflexive modesty.
Easy there.
Mia put up a hand.
I'm not saying it was the St. Crispin's Day speech, just that not everyone who heard it thought you were a complete wanker.
That might still be overly generous, observed Christopher,
glancing up with a strained smile. Oliver did something smile-like and tentative back.
Fuck off, Chris.
The sky, which had been making passive-aggressive suggestions about rain all day, finally followed through, and a light drizzle began to descend on the courtyard. And for a while we sat there being wet and cathartically glum. But despite Oliver dropping a kiloton truth bomb all over his father's funeral, we weren't done with social obligations yet. So I hauled myself to my feet and tried to hustle our little group in the direction of the cars. Come on, I told them. We're missing the death party.
I think they're calling them wakes these days,
said Mia, taking Christopher by the hand. As we walked away from the crematorium, Oliver turned to his brother.
How long are you in town for, by the way?
Christopher cast him a slightly suspicious look.
A week or so.
We should... That is, if you'd like to catch up.
It wasn't quite a suggestion, but Oliver's voice sounded faintly hopeful. After a moment, Christopher nodded.
That'd be nice.
The four of us walked on in comfortable silence through the flower-strewn, not too corpse factory-ish garden of the crematorium, where even now David Blackwood's body was being consigned to ashes. If I'd been in a poetic mood, I'd have said the rain made it feel like the sky was doing our crying for us. But this was Britain. Rain was just another fact of life, like taxes, or the other thing. Chapter 34. So, wakes, huh? They sucked.
If funerals were easier than weddings because no one was expected to enjoy them, then wakes might have sucked harder because you sort of were. I mean, not in a munchkin village way, but in an in the midst of death we are in life, the deceased would want us to be joyful way. And that was a really specific mood. A really specific mood that was hard enough to achieve at the best of times, and even harder to achieve when the deceased had actually been kind of a dick, and everybody knew it. It was practically impossible to achieve when the deceased had been kind of a dick and everybody knew it, and his eldest son had stood up and said he was a kind of dick and everybody knew it, and now 50 people were united not so much in their shared grief as their shared determination to pretend that one particular thing had never happened. Which meant for Oliver, the whole event was like a very low-key but ultimately merciful gaslighting, as he went around his parents' house shaking hands with the men, kissing the women lightly on the cheek, and saying, "Yes, a terrible loss, and so unexpected," roughly 12 times a minute. Eventually, he and his mother reached the point in their separate rotations where they couldn't avoid each other without admitting they were trying to avoid each other. Oliver's hand tightened on mine in a way that at least hinted at panic. "Mother," he began, before she went up on tiptoes to kiss him lightly on the cheek.
"Oliver, darling, don't forget to pay the caterers."
He gave the slightest of blinks.
"I put through a bank transfer yesterday. It should clear within 24 hours.
"Thank you."
And with a nod as slight as Oliver's blink, Miriam Blackwood moved on. "Walk," I suggested, because I could feel Oliver starting to vibrate beside me. He didn't say yes or no, but he let me lead him outside. The Blackwoods had a really nice garden, although I hadn't had much chance to enjoy it the last time I was here. Not that I was going to have much chance now either, what with the drizzle, the fact I was at a wake, and the distress Oliver was radiating like a rubbish halo. They were also middle class enough to have a gazebo, which seemed as good a place as any to shelter from the 1-2 punch of rain and social obligation.
"Have I paid the caterers?" said Oliver bitterly, as we sat down on one of the little benches.
"It could have been worse," I offered. "She could have said, 'You suck, you ruined your father's funeral.'"
"I might have preferred it if she had."
He ran a hand through his hair.
"As it is, I think she's saving that particular bombshell for a future disagreement."
I rested my head on his shoulder. "If it helps, so am I." That earned a soft laugh. "Next time you're like, 'Lucian, you've left your mug out again,' I can be like, 'Yeah, well, at least I didn't ruin my father's funeral.'"
"Ah."
He put an arm around me.
"What a joy our life together shall be."
There was a slight pause.
"Assuming, that is, you still want to."
"Want to what?" I asked. "Leave my mug out."
"Have a life together."
Another of those tense little pauses.
"I'm just aware that this has been a lot. That I've, perhaps, been a lot."
I gave him an unhelpfully angled eye roll. "Oliver, it's not your job to make being with you convenient for me. Just like it's not my job to make being with me convenient for you. Which is good, because if it was my job, I'd have been fucking fired ages ago."
"Being with you is...
He broke off for what felt like an unflatteringly long time.
"I sometimes don't know what I'd do without you. Again," he followed up hastily, "not in a suicidal ideation way."
"You know," I said, "I'm getting increasingly worried you feel the need to clarify that."
"I'm a barrister. Clarity is my job. And what I'm saying is, obviously I'd cope without you, because wonderful as you are, I like to think this isn't a codependent relationship. But I'd rather not have to. My life is more interesting with you in it. And you make me a worse person."
I sat up. "Thanks?"
That sounded more flattering in my head.
"How did it sound in your head?" I asked. "You just told me I make you worse, as in less good."
I thought it would be a sort of witty, Wildean reversal.
How do you ever win a case? Do you stand in front of the jury and say, you should send this guy to prison? Psych.
What I meant to say.
Oliver was using his, you're being mean to me and I secretly like it voice, which was just different enough from his, you're being mean to me and I very much don't like it voice, that we'd avoided some major misunderstandings.
Is that I've spent a lot of my life living by a set of rules that I never really interrogated, and you make me interrogate them. I would never have been able to do what I did today without you. And maybe I shouldn't have. Maybe it was a dreadful mistake. But I'm inordinately grateful that I was able to do it.
Oh, I said, trying to not melt into a pile of squish and then drain away in the drizzle. So I'm your helpful shoulder demon.
Oliver nodded. Intermittently helpful.
I will very much take that. It was inappropriate to make out at a wake, even if we were technically outside the wake in a damp gazebo, so we had a long hug instead. And I was honestly a bit embarrassed to be a long hug-having person, but sometimes you just had to long hug. We were at about the 80% mark on the long hug, when to my dismay, I saw Uncle Jim making his way towards us across the garden.
"Really gave the old man what for, eh?"
he yell said from the steps. Oliver and I de-hugged and sort of stared at him. It wasn't so much the intrusion as the shock of somebody admitting that the inappropriate eulogy of doom had actually happened. As ever, Oliver pulled himself together faster than I did.
"I'm sorry, Uncle Jim. I know he was your brother, and I'm sorry."
Uncle Jim shrugged.
"Probably a bloody silly thing to do, all told."
"Yes," agreed Oliver, moodily.
"Still,"
continued Uncle Jim,
"you were right. He had it coming."
That wasn't what I'd expected, and Oliver seemed to be languishing in a similar state of flummoxosity. Ascending into the gazebo, Uncle Jim pulled up an iron garden chair and sat down opposite us.
"Be honest with you," he said. "I wish I'd had the balls to tell him to go fuck himself too. And your granddad, for that matter."
"I wouldn't call it balls,"
Oliver replied. Given the audience, he didn't add that he thought it was inappropriately cis and gender normative to associate one particular set of gonads with emotional strength, but he was clearly thinking it quite loudly.
"I'd got to the point where I felt it was... Well, I suppose I explained my reasoning fairly extensively already."
Uncle Jim nodded.
"You did. You did. There comes a point, doesn't there? One where you've got to make a choice. Stand up for yourself, or spend your whole life getting walked over."
Out of nowhere, he heaved a sigh so heavy, I thought it was going to shake the roof off our little shelter and leave us all to run back inside or get drizzled on.
"Suppose, looking back, I think I made the wrong one."
"I always thought you two got on."
The tone in Oliver's voice was careful, like he was sneaking up on a butterfly and didn't want to spook it.
"Oh, we did. Best friends our whole lives. I mean, he was my big brother. How could I not think he was the business?"
"You could have met him," I suggested, before I could stop myself. Uncle Jim laughed.
"I like you, Luke. In fact, thinking about it, I suppose all this telling people to go fuck themselves was you from the start, wasn't it?"
There really didn't seem to be a good way to answer that.
"I'm not sure I'd put it quite..." "Told me to go fuck myself, as I recall. As part of the group, I mean."
"I think you might have been collateral damage," I suggested. With an only half-listening shrug, Uncle Jim moved on.
"But yes, we were close. Thick as thieves. But that's the thing about thieves. They're not especially famous for being nice to each other."
He lapsed into a melancholy silence, and I let myself think back on what I knew about David and James Blackwood. They'd always struck me as of a type, the kind of bluff, untouchable older man who'd been raised to see no difference between humour and cruelty. They'd had something of a ringleader sidekick vibe about them, certainly, and perhaps that was all you needed to know,
After all, who was more scared of the school bully than the school bully's best friend?
He was a good man, our dad,
Uncle Jim was saying, as much to himself, it seemed, as to anybody else.
Honest, hard-working, wouldn't stand for nonsense. Made sure David and me got good careers that set us up for life, and I'm grateful for that. So was David.
Leaning forward, Oliver did his best to engage.
I suppose I didn't know him that well.
No, he wasn't the affectionate sort. Approved of grandchildren, but didn't care for them.
I remember,
said Oliver, his own voice growing a little distant now.
He stopped giving us birthday presents the moment we turned 16.
Old enough to earn a living, agreed Uncle Jim. And David was just like him, not quite as of that generation, of course, but a lot of the same values. Neither of them had any time for layabouts, or weaklings, or sissies.
I wasn't quite sure where this was going, but the shape of somewhere it could be going was beginning to schlump together out of the haze of rain and reminiscence in front of me.
Did Father often make you feel like a sissy?
Asked Oliver, who seemed to be seeing the same schlumping possibility that I was. A possibility that made a depressing kind of sense for an unmarried man in his 60s, who'd spent his whole life in the shadow of an older brother with no time for anyone he didn't approve of.
I looked up to him.
The fact that Uncle Jim hadn't entirely answered Oliver's question wasn't lost on either of us.
Tried to be like him. Wasn't.
That might have been for the best,
Oliver pointed out.
I'm not sure he was the sort of man it's a good idea to emulate.
Now Uncle Jim was staring fixedly into the middle distance.
You know they say you can't put old heads on young shoulders. But I'll tell you this. You worked that out far sooner than I did.
Shoulders of giants, Uncle Jim,
offered Oliver, with what I thought might have been unnecessary kindness. Another longish silence followed. The fine rain on the roof sounded like an endless bag of rice being emptied into a pan that somehow never filled. At last, Uncle Jim turned back to us.
Caught me once, you know, at school. I remember he didn't say anything, but the look on his face was... I mean, in the man's defence, it had only been legal a few years at that point. I don't think I ever quite got over it. Then when you... Well, he didn't say anything then either, not to me.
To me?
Oliver's voice was almost impossibly gentle, certainly gentler than I'd have managed with a man who had been happily joining in with jokes at Oliver's expense the last time we'd met.
He said, as long as you don't start wearing dresses. Mother said, but what about AIDS?
Uncle Jim gave another gazebo-shaking sigh.
At least that was something. Still, it's too late now. He's gone, and I'm...
Not?
Oliver finished for him.
Old, corrected Uncle Jim. I'm an old, bald, fat man who left it all too late. From telling his brother to go fuck himself to everything else.
Hoping I wasn't treading on too many toes, and that this fell under the broader category of LGBTQ+ community, rather than the Blackwoods specifically, I stuck my oar in. I mean, I told him, I suppose it is too late to tell David to go fuck himself, unless you wanted to do it to his ashes. But as for the everything else bit, there's still time on that. Uncle Jim gave a snort.
What, should I buy myself a pair of those leather trousers with the bum cut out and go strolling around St. James's Park?
And there was the Uncle Jim we knew and loathed.
For what it's worth,
said Oliver, with a level of patience that I was at once in awe of, and a little worried I took for granted.
I've never worn leather trousers with the bum cut out in my life. Meaning no disrespect to people who have. Most people prefer to go cruising on the internet these days. Or Hampstead Heath, if you'd rather.
I still don't... Uncle Jim began. But apparently he still wasn't sure what he still didn't. So he let the thought trail away into nothing.
Oliver stood and went to crouch by his uncle.
And you don't have to. There's no...
He looked at me.
No right or wrong way to be who you are. If you're happy being...
The fat, bald bachelor in his 60s, suggested Jim.
If you're happy with your life the way it is...
Oliver continued doing his best to ignore Jim's scathing opinion of himself.
You don't have to change it. But if you want to explore alternatives, then there are alternatives.
Uncle Jim looked down at Oliver.
There aren't, Oliver. Not at my age.
There are apps, I suggested. Oliver nodded reassuringly.
And social clubs, if they're more your speed. The world's changing a lot for older men, and often for the better.
Perhaps.
The look in Uncle Jim's eyes was the closest to thoughtful I'd ever seen him.
Still, change isn't something I'm used to.
Of course.
Oliver's tone was achingly careful.
As long as you realise that it doesn't have to happen overnight, and that you don't have to be in a relationship to be...
Don't, said Uncle Jim. Not out loud. I...
He hauled himself to his feet.
Good speech today, he said. Really gave the old man what for. Had it coming.
Then he turned and walked back to the house.
Part 5. Oliver David Blackwood and Lucien O'Donnell. The Green Room, Camden, 26th of March. Chapter 35.
For God's sake, Lucien.
Oliver's beautifully tidy living room was now, and had been since Christmas, a chaos of increasingly complex index cards, charts, binders, and calendars. At one point, I'd tried to tease him about their impact on our carbon footprint, but it hadn't ended well.
I'm not asking you to do much, but you should have booked a band by now.
I wince cringed. I know. I meant to do it last week. It's just... Are we totally sure we don't want to go with a DJ? It'd be a lot cheaper, and I don't think anybody especially cares if there's live music.
We had this conversation.
An exasperated tone was creeping into Oliver's voice. He'd been exasperated for a while.
And we agreed.
For once, I didn't let that slide. I'm not sure we actually agreed. I think we disagreed and eventually stopped talking about it, and you took that as meaning I'd back down. Oliver threw his hands in the air, which was about 12 times more extravagant than any gesture I'd seen him make pre-wedding, and was now the kind of thing he did all the time.
Fine, we'll get a DJ. We can have a 50-something failed musician pumping dad rock over tinny speakers the whole evening.
Good DJs do exist, I pointed out. I can get Priya to recommend somebody if you want.
Invoking people who weren't us, I'd learned, was a reasonable way to get Oliver to calm down. It was sort of Pavlovian, the spectre of an audience making his what-will-the-neighbours-think instincts kick in.
I'm very fond of Priya, he said, but don't her tastes run a little alternative?
It's a gay wedding, Oliver, I reminded him, for what might have been the 100th time. There's no point trying to make it not alternative, because in the eyes of the law and most of society, it's alternative by definition. Moving a stack of papers that I tried really hard to keep in the right order, I sat on the sofa. Besides, it's not like Priya has no sense of occasion. She wouldn't send us somebody who'd play lesbian thrash metal over the vows. And also, would there be anything wrong with having a DJ playing lesbian thrash metal?
Oliver looked up sharply from his spot on the rug.
Yes,
the fact that it would be thrash metal. I am not getting married to thrash metal, lesbian or otherwise. I don't think that's a personality flaw. I think that's a very reasonable preference.
Fine, I'll book us a string quartet.
I didn't say book a string quartet. You can book whoever you like. I tried to roll my eyes without Oliver noticing. It didn't work.
What I would like is to save a few quid, get a bloke with a laptop, and not have to use my zero musical knowledge to decide which of 9 identical-seeming groups of blokes in waistcoats are going to do covers of Ed Sheeran songs at the only wedding we're ever going to have, especially since neither of us like Ed Sheeran.
I thought Photograph had its moments.
Photograph does not have its moments, I yelled. No Ed Sheeran song has moments. I can't believe I'm marrying someone who thought Photograph had moments.
Oliver threw his hands in the air again.
You're marrying someone who is occasionally able to resist the hipsterish urge to dislike popular things.
I like plenty of popular things.
My head was starting to hurt. Talking to my boyfriend was actually giving me a headache.
It's just none of them are made by smug ginger men.
Lucian.
Clutching at his forehead like he too was getting a headache, Oliver ticked something decisively off his list.
Hire a band. I don't care which band, but hire a band.
Fine. Do you want The Shine, Harvest Moon, or Ulysses?
What part of I don't care am I failing to communicate? Snarled Oliver.
And do you not think, I asked, that it is kind of fucked up that you don't care what band we hire?
There's no point caring. The wedding is in 3 weeks. The choice now is either band or no band.
Or DJ, I pointed out. There was a pause. Then Oliver turned around and stared like he didn't recognise me.
Oh my God. This was your plan all along, wasn't it? We agreed on a band.
We didn't agree.
You said that you'd book one.
You told me to book one.
And then you just dragged your feet until it was too late, so you could get your own way regardless. And that, Lucian, is exactly the kind of thing your father would do.
It was, but that was pretty fucking rich coming from Mr. My Way or the Highway.
Oh, right, yeah, I'm definitely the one acting like his father here, because this high-handed, controlling, patriarchal, weirdly heteronormative attitude you're taking doesn't remind me of anybody at all.
One of the many difficult quirks of my relationship with Oliver was that we had diametrically opposed anger reactions. And now Oliver was anger reacting all over the place, which for him meant getting very tense and calm.
It isn't weirdly heteronormative, he said, not to want to get married in a pub.
That was another old argument, and another one where we'd sort of stopped talking, and then Oliver had invented a compromise out of nowhere. It wasn't a pub. It was a vintage venue space with an attached bar, and I thought it was nice. You, on the other hand, wanted to get married in a Victorian banqueting hall full of pictures of dead white men.
Firstly, Oliver began counting on his fingers, it's Elizabethan. Secondly, it seems a little appropriative and disingenuous to complain about pictures of dead white men when we are ourselves both white men. Thirdly, that venue was at Gray's Inn, which has personal significance for me because it's a body I actually belong to. And fourthly, we didn't go with that venue either, so I don't know what you're complaining about.
Defeated, I slumped backwards. And as I did, my left arm flopped with an uncontrolled floppishness that caught the stack of papers, whose order I had so carefully preserved, and sent them tumbling to the floor in a mess of sticky tags and handwritten notes. Oliver grew very still indeed.
Lucian,
he said in his most carefully regulated monotone,
I feel like your presence here is becoming unhelpful.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If Oliver's anger instinct was to get super-duper calm, mine was to get super-duper sarcastic, which was probably less mature, but also probably healthier in the long run.
Is my involvement in our wedding becoming inconvenient?
Now you're being...
If you dare say I'm being childish, I am getting up and walking out of that door.
Oliver gave me a cold, distant look that I'd seen a couple of times before but had never imagined would be directed at me.
Right at this moment, that might be the most practical thing you can do. Leave this to me, Lucien. I'll have everything finished by the time you're back.
He didn't have to tell me twice. It had been ages since I'd had a good storm up. I stormed. I stormed so extravagantly that I ended up at my mum's house.
Look!
She opened the door with a look of puzzlement on her face that quickly became one of concern.
Oh no, what has happened? Have you discovered Oliver randomly travels in time and so you have known him your whole life and are only just beginning to realise it?
So, I asked, you've been watching Doctor Who or reading The Time Traveller's Wife? She shrugged.
A bit of both. In different ways, they are very creepy men.
Doctor Who's a woman now.
Oh no, Luke, spoilers. I am only up to the one with the big scarf. Anyway...
She stood aside.
You had better come in. I'm afraid I did not know you were visiting, so I have not made the special curry.
I followed her into the living room, which always had a faint air of Judy and dogs, despite, at the moment, containing neither. I think I'll live.
You should eat something, mon canton. Food is important when you've had a shock.
Just to clarify, I said, adopting a position of sofa-ly slumpertide, I've had a shock because I've had a fight with Oliver about the wedding, not about him being a time traveller. We're on the same page there, right?
You know.
Mum sat down beside me and dragged the coffee table towards us.
I am very happy for you to come here and talk to me about anything you like, even if Oliver is not a time traveller. But you are going to have to make yourself useful for once and help me with my jigsaw.
I stared at the coffee table, which was strewn with little clumps of a partially assembled picture in a sea of pieces, many of them upside down. What on earth are you doing?
Jigsaws are good for people of my age. They stop you getting the Alzheimer's.
Okay, but... I kept staring, pushing back a rising suspicion that I was very much the Oliver in this room. Why are you not starting with the edges?
Why would I do that?
Embarrassingly, I had to think about it. Everybody starts with the edges. It gives you something to... It's more efficient. Oh my God, I was Oliver. Or maybe it was Jigsaw's. Were we all, deep down, an Oliver, and all it took to bring it out was a disassembled picture of the Moomins?
No,
Mum said firmly.
Efficient is not cutting the picture up in the first place. Doing a jigsaw is not about efficiency. It is about the journey.
I gave her a look. You mean the real jigsaw is the friends we make along the way? She gave me a look back.
No, Luke. A jigsaw is a jigsaw. Your friends are your friends. You cannot be friends with a jigsaw. What are you even talking about?
It's just a thing people say. A light of what was probably misplaced understanding glimmered in her eyes.
Ah, bon. Then, yes, it is about being, as they say, friends with a jigsaw. One is not efficient when one is being friends with a jigsaw. Now,
her tone grew brisk,
help me be friends with this jigsaw, because I am quite stuck.
She squinted at her various clusters of Moomin.
I am looking for the last piece of Papa's hat.
And you don't think it'd be better to... I let it go, and started combing through the 926 pieces that remained in the 1,000-piece jigsaw to find the one bit that had a fragment of Moomin top hat on it. To Mum's credit, it was quite a relaxing process. I mean, I don't think I became friends with a jigsaw, but I did get to know a reasonable amount about it.
So...
asked Mum, holding a piece to the light like she was checking it wasn't a forgery.
What has happened with you and Oliver?
Obviously, it was complex,
and there were two sides to every story, and Mum cared about both of us, and if I wanted her to give me good advice, I'd present the situation in the fairest, most impartial way I could. "He was just a dick," I explained. "He's been a dick for months." There was a pause, Mum carefully finishing Moomin Mama's bowl of fruit.
"Are you sure? Because you know I love you, but between you and Oliver, if I had to guess who was the bigger dick, I would not normally expect it to be him."
"Thanks. And I've been very reasonable, while he's turned into some kind of steamrollery wedding tyrant." Another pause, as Mum either thought about this or got distracted by weird blue-eyed children.
"Marriage is complicated, and weddings are complicated, but most importantly, weddings are not marriages."
"Are you sure?" I demanded. "Because you know what they say. Steamrollery wedding tyrant me once, shame on you. Steamrollery wedding tyrant me for the rest of my life, shame on me."
"I do not like that idiom as much as be friends with a jigsaw," Mum sighed. "I can see why you are concerned. But you have been with Oliver for more than 2 years, and he has never been like this before."
"Actually," I admitted, "he's quite like this. But I thought I liked it."
"And you don't anymore?"
I tried to wedge a piece of top hat into place, but it turned out to be part of a cat's arse. "It just feels different now. Everything is all... I don't know."
"He's also just lost his father," Mum pointed out. "That can be very hard."
"Yeah, but I felt that made us closer. Like, if anything was going to break us, it should have been that, and it didn't. So why is it going to shit now?" Mum put a consoling arm around me.
"It is hard to say without knowing what type of shit it is. There are lots of different types of shit, and they are all shit in different ways."
"It's sort of..." I tried to pin my thoughts down, but, thematically enough, it was like trying to nail shit to the wall. "We're arguing kind of constantly about everything. And we never used to, not like this. And this morning we had the biggest fight we've basically ever had. And if you put a gun to my head, I'm not sure what it was really even about. And just, is that what it's going to be like? Is that what being married will be like?" With typical sang-froid, Mum shrugged.
"Probably not. Probably that is what organizing big life-changing events with lots of guests and rules and expectations together will be like. And you don't do that very often."
"We did it fine for the funeral," I pointed out.
"That was not the same. It was his father, and so he had the right to be a steamrollery tyrant if he wanted to. But your wedding, that is for both of you."
"Oliver doesn't seem to have got that memo," I told her, glumly. Mum turned to look at me. There was an interrogating expression on her face I felt quite ambivalent about.
"Are you sure you sent it to him?"
"Well, I think so."
"Because the look I know, he is not the sort of boy who would get cut out of his own wedding."
That was kind of her. The look I knew would get cut out of his own funeral. Except if Oliver was cutting me out in order to create the heteronormative marriage of his dreams, you'd think he'd be happier about it. "I'm not even sure it's that," I said. "I'm involved. We're both involved. It just doesn't feel like us anymore."
"Ah."
Mum looked sage.
"Perhaps it is too many chefs. They are spoiling the sauce."
"There's not even that many chefs. Like, I know the wedding cliché is everybody else is trying to get you to do their thing, but normally that's the families, and my family is you, and Oliver's family isn't even speaking to him, so this is totally on us. We're fucking up our own sauce." There was a long silence. Mum's sage look had intensified.
"Luke,"
she frowned solemnly,
Why is there a wolf in a wig in this picture?
You're the one who bought a Moomin jigsaw. The only Moomins I know are the one in the hat and the other one. Now, can we get back to my catastrophically overboiled sauce wedding?
I thought you would appreciate the distraction.
Mum slotted a bit of wigwolf into place.
As for the sauce wedding, well, have you thought that maybe, maybe not every dish is meant to have a sauce?
I turned from the jigsaw. What are you saying?
Well, for example, there is a nice Chinese place in the next village, and they do this sort of dry chili and garlic chicken, and it is very good.
No, I mean, what is this metaphor implying about me and Oliver? For a moment, Mum seemed to genuinely resent my pulling her thoughts back from the dry chili and garlic chicken.
I mean, mon canton, that you and Oliver may not be the sort who are good at being married.
Inside, I mega winced. The comparison here was obvious. Like you and Dad, you mean?
No, Luke.
Mum looked at me like I was six, and I just told her I thought cats were made of marzipan.
Your father and I were not bad at being married. We were bad at him not being a lying, cheating sack of broken penises who only thinks about himself.
But if we're not good at being married, what can we be good at? Another of Mum's trademark shrugs.
Being not married? After all, you don't need to, not really.
I tasted something bitter, a mix of superfood salad and bile. For a moment, Miriam Blackwood popped up at the back of my mind, saying, I don't understand why gay people want to get married at all. Sitting back on the sofa, I shuffled slightly farther away from Mum. Things had got uncomfortable suddenly, and I wasn't used to Pucklethroop in the Wold being uncomfortable. That's... My stomach was making warbling motions, and I didn't like it. That's not okay to say.
Why not?
Mum seemed genuinely shocked. My skin was feeling crawly, in a way I didn't want to be associating with my mum's house. Because that's... That's what people like Oliver's parents say. Why do you have to get married? It's not like you can have babies.
Oh, Luke.
She didn't come any closer. She was usually pretty good at respecting personal space, probably from years of talking people down from bad trips. But her body language got all non-threatening.
I did not mean it in that way. I only meant that there are some people who are very good together but are not so good at weddings or at being married. Look at Judy. She has had very many boyfriends, all very happily, but her marriages, they never last.
I tried to let myself calm down. Isn't that mostly because her husbands keep getting murdered or disappearing mysteriously somewhere on Dartmoor?
Oh, now be fair. That only happened twice.
Now that I was recovering from my brief, was Mama stealth homophobe scare, I realised she was trying to comfort me. And then I realised the reason she was trying to comfort me was because I might be too sucky to get married. But, I flailed, everybody is married. My best friend is married. My dickhead ex is married. What does it say about me, about us, if we're the only ones who can't make it work?
I know this is not very helpful.
Mum had gone back to the Wigan Wolf.
But I think it means what you let it mean.
I vindictively returned a piece of Moomin Papa's top hat to the pile. You're right, Mum, that isn't very helpful. Because what it means to me right now is that I'm a gigantic failure who can't make it work even with a guy as amazing as Oliver. Mum sighed.
You know I love Oliver, and I think he is very good for you. But he is also, and there is no getting away from this, kind of a messy bitch.
Mum! I yelped.
It's okay. I'm using it in the reclaimed sense.
I should never have taught you that.
All I am saying is...
She gave a little shrug,
then pounced on the piece of top hat I'd tried to hide from her.
You both have your issues. This is not about your failure or is. It's about what's right for both of you.
Well, I told her, in a voice that was definitely decisive and not at all huffy, what's best for me at the moment is going to fucking bed. And for the second time that day, I treated myself to a storm.